I'll introduce Paul, my colleague Paul Thompson from Leeds Beckett University. Thank you, Paul, for staying up and joining us.
My pleasure.
On the eve after your birthday. So So happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
And Amadine, do you want to do Kelsey and James?
Sure. And happy birthday, Paul.
Thank you.
Awesome. So James, my dear friend, who I know since 2007, right? One of my first colleagues in Canada. So James is the head engineer of the audio recording engineer practicum of the Banff Center, right? Which is not so open right now, or partly open. And so we've been working together on this research partnership for about 3 years now, trying to combine forces to improve audio education, and not just here in Canada, but also internationally, as we are doing some work with West African producers, as you just saw if you were here with us this morning. So thank you, James, for accepting this invitation. And I think I will also introduce Kelsey, as a fifth year, right? Digital Audio Arts major at the University of Lethbridge. And I asked Kelsey to facilitate the roundtable today because she conducted a project about the perception of mixing techniques by untrained listeners, pretty much the people who are supposed to make us live and pay for what we do. And so what do they think? And so I think her perspective on mixing was quite innovative, and asking the right questions that we don't always ask ourselves when we're working in the studio and when we teach young audio engineers. So I thought she would bring a very cool very cool perspective on this discussion. Kelsey, it's yours.
So kind of as James said, the calling technical ear training versus critical listening is it's a little bit of overlap there, especially because critical listening is what we do every day. In the opening of his 2004 paper, Speaking of Sound, Thomas Percello imagines a list of what one has to learn in order to become a sound engineer. He describes a nuanced jack-of-all-trades list that includes musical skill and knowledge, electricity, acoustics. But he explains that there's something missing from the list that's a large part of a sound engineer's tool belt, which is the acquisition and use of language heard in a studio setting. If we imagine this tool belt, there are a number of different things that any one engineer could have in theirs. Porcello discusses the process of professionalization, of people, of terms and skills, and of language. The acquisition of professionalized language and finding confidence in what those terms really mean to our own ears, I think, is something that is somewhat missing from our education programs. In my recent research study, looking at their perception of untrained listeners, of audio by untrained listeners, I determined that the main difference between trained and untrained listeners is that language at their disposal. I cite Shingle-Bielefeld et al., 2013, I believe, in saying that the main difference isn't actually perception, but rather the fact that trained listeners have experience with preceding listening tests, and they have a better idea of what audio should correspond to which reading. I will start the discussion here with this idea of corresponding previous listenings with your current perception. Critical listening and technical ear training exist in different capacities depending on where you study. That's the key part here, is that it's part of your studies. So does this discussion have to focus on educational contexts? Not necessarily, but does it happen anywhere else in professional worlds, at least semi-frequently? In your experience?
I was going to make the point sort of that at the end of James's presentation, I think that your study and the work that you're doing connects those things really nicely. As you mentioned, Thomas Percello is a social anthropologist. He's interested, and he's a linguistic anthropologist, interested about how we communicate through words. And I think I think that's what really helps to connect technical ear training with the social environment and the social context of the recording studio is language. Until there's a cable from my head to yours, the only thing that we have sometimes to be able to describe our intentions or the way in which we are experiencing a particular sonic artifact is through the use of language. And I think technical ear training has the possibility of increasing that level of a shared lexicon, I think, in which we're able to do that. Because to be honest, Kelsey, I thought your research was really fascinating, and I thought it was a great starting point, because the graph that James showed was all about trained and untrained listeners and what happens after they've gone through a process of technical ear training. When in actual fact, your research is, well, let's see where people are up to right now. What's missing from where they're at the moment. So I just thought that was really interesting. I think the social context of the recording studio throws up many questions that I think either technical ear training or even critical listening they're not able to answer. And importantly, they're probably not able to answer on their own. I think James made some really, really good points throughout his presentation. My favorite one was, it's like practicing stick figures when you want to paint a portrait. And I must admit, I think that's where I begin to struggle with technical ear training, that goes all the way back to sine waves. Well, in the recording studio, we are I was going to say never recording a sine wave. I have done that. But we're more often than not, we are dealing with complex audio material. We're dealing with instruments. There has to be some way where we think actually, and I think actually, as you started putting program material in, James, into that, into Jason Corey's online tool, it began to make more sense to me. It's like, okay, if I boost this area of the frequency spectrum by a certain amount, what does it sound like? And I think that's a really useful way to begin. I've got loads of things to say, so please come back to me.
Well, just to touch on Paul's point in response to the question of like that language and human communication is, you know, all we have until there's those cables in our brains. One of the challenges that you have in teaching critical listening and teaching technical ear training in large groups is that it's so hard to have a dialogue where, you know, when I'm teaching it one-on-one with someone, a big part of that one-on-one interaction is them trying to hear what I'm hearing and me trying to hear what they're hearing and discussing that. And how can you teach some, how, you know, you can't just say like, do it like this. And they're like, I can't do it. And you're just like, do it like this. And it's just a bunch of assholes yelling at each other. Whereas if it's like, can you hear in the upper mids? Can you hear, you know, and it's like coming up with that language and just going through that process of struggling to be hearing the same things in the face of the same sound, in itself is a great practice for, you know, what we'll end up doing with artists forever.
Yeah, I think, you know, George Martin, the Beatles. Sorry, I'm a Dean, I mentioned the Beatles. But, you know, we're however many minutes in now. You know, his famous example was trying to translate. And I think, you know, part of the process of what producers do is just an act of translation of what do they mean when they say particular things. I'm always fascinated. I'm a big soccer fan, I'm a big football fan. And I'm always fascinated at the end of the game when they interview footballers and everyone's like, oh, well, they didn't say much. And it's because their first language is the game. They're playing the game in the language that it's meant to be played. And they are translating at the end and giving us a series of cliches at the end. And I think as musicians and engineers, we're also doing the same thing. Our first language is sound in a way. And the thing that you introduced today, James, about that technical ear training Because I didn't realize it was as that much, you know, it was as one-on-one as it is. I mean, you're right, for you know, a university like ours, where we've got maybe 550 to 600 students across four courses, that ain't going to fly at our place. So it's interesting that actually, once you get down to it, it works one-to-one. But as you sort of try and make it work for larger programs, then it kind of breaks down, because it relies on that area of communication and language and understanding. And I think it goes back to Kelsey's work as well, is understanding the type of terminology that people have already in their auditory memory banks.
I've seen, you know, some successful implementations where there's, you know, massive computer labs and everyone on headphones, and, you know, an instructor that's kind of going around and sort of dropping in for little coaching moments. But even that, I think a symptom of that kind of environment is that it becomes boring, which is easily confused with unrewarding. And it's really something that is as rewarding as the work someone puts into it. And so if the process is unrewarding, it'll be a sort of, you know, downward spiral into just not doing it or not paying attention while doing it. And so it's a really, like, almost what needs to happen is just like sort of mad science classes in the studio, where it's like the instructor is playing with a scenario of trying to, like, break their gear to the, you know, push everything to the limits and, like, explore what these parameter controls do, and just inspire people to do that with their studio time. And then just to be like, look, if the studio's not in use 24/7, I don't know what you're doing with your lives. Because it's just like, you don't have to have a commercial transaction going on, you know, or a simulation of a commercial transaction where it's like, I'm recording another student for free, but still it's basically a simulation of what I'll be doing for a living later. That's not the only reason to use a production space, especially when you're a student.
You should tell my students that'd be great. I did want to raise a particular point in that, you know, the Jason Corey's online tools, great, and I think you made the critical point that for EQ it really works, but for other types of processing it sort of breaks down. And again, that's another issue that I have specifically with this type of ear training. It's certainly useful on a parameter level, but actually as engineers and producers, we choose different types of equipment because of the way that it sounds or what it does to a process. And so I wonder whether, you know, the next level up is that you're able to load in a particular EQ unit, or you load in a particular compressor, or you load in a particular reverb, and that, I don't know, that it's way more impactful and powerful to your auditory memory as you're learning about these, the changing these particular parameters. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
Sort of like the next step from those, like, microphone emulation microphones, where it's like, buy this one mic and a piece of software, it's every mic now. Like, that's, we must be close to, I mean, already things like Altiverb that have impulses of, you know, a million old pieces of gear, but we must be pretty close to there being those kind of libraries of digitized simulations of things, and being able to play with those. And then another thing that, again, is hard to do in a large scale, but it's easy to do on, you know, in self-study situations, is if you have multiple versions of the same gear, you know, a hardware 1176 and three different plug-in 1176s. And, like, the idea of, you know, whatever, passing program through all of them and saying, I like this one better than that one, is kind of I don't feel like that's information. I don't feel like there's learning involved in, like, deciding your preference using, but, like, in sort of comparing them and seeing where the differences are and how the differences are when they're, you know, sliming super hard versus when they're just tickling something, as an exercise in being able to hear, being able to perceive small differences, I think is tremendously helpful, because all of what we do is, you know, an infinite amount of tiny changes are possible, and there's always going to be someone saying, can we have a bit more of this, a bit more of that, a bit less this, and split the difference between those things. And, you know, being able to tell when you can't tell the difference between those two things, so whatever, let's just move on. And we can't tell the difference, and it does matter, I think, is a crucial skill.
All right, well, kind of just jumping off of what you said there, obviously there are infinite little tweaks that you can make in every Sonic aspect you can imagine. And it's hard to lose context. So obviously there's a lot of discussion about context as a very important part of our music. Sure, your guitar sounds great, but as soon as you unsolo it. Yeah, so do you think that I believe that you could argue that these technical ear training exercises are very out of context. So do you think that, is there a way to put them in context? And B, whether it's in or out of context, does it make effective sound engineers?
I mean, my answer to that will be pretty short, where I really draw a parallel to it with athletics training. And it's just, you know, if you're a runner, you can be the greatest runner without ever going to the gym, right? All you do is run. That's the best kind of training for what you want to be excellent at. But there are ways you can accelerate that. You know, I'm a rock climber, and so, you know, I can just hang from my fingers off of a doorway, and that will help strengthen my weakest link for when I go and actually climb. But if I never go and actually climb, I'm still going to suck at actually climbing, no matter how much I hang from a doorway. So it's the same thing. Like, you can be a great engineer and never have done any technical ear training because you're actually working the skills. But if we can come up with the right technical ear training sort of regimen for each person individually, and so again, you kind of have to do that for yourself, it can accelerate your improvements. You know, you can spend 5 hours a week on ear training, and it'll give you the improvements of having spent an extra 15 hours a week in the studio. Ideally, you know, if all goes well, if it works, if it's good, that's what we're aiming for, is a sort of acceleration of skill development. But it's definitely, it's super easy to get distracted by the game of a technical ear training task and not have it apply to the real world.
I definitely agree with that, and I'd probably argue about just a little bit, James, about your analogy, because there's almost a step missing, and it is about context. You know, for those people on this Zoom who have raced, you know, in athletics, but there is race technique. You know, you can be the fastest runner, you can be the best runner, you can do all the training, you can do all the strength training in the gym. But if you don't pick up the pace at the right time, or if you don't follow the right people, or if you don't cut in at a certain time, then you don't win. And I think that, you know, in technical ear training has to spiral up as well as spiral down. And technical ear training is spiraling down at that minimal level. It's analyzing those points. And I think that can be incredibly useful, but it's almost useless if it's not connected later to the context. So as Kelsey said, you know, yeah, your guitar sounds great in solo, and you unsolo it, and then it sounds awful because the drums are doing something, or the bass is doing something different, or, you know, Kirk's playing on his Hammond organ or whatever it is. And I think context is key, and context is huge, actually. You know, it isn't just about how the musical elements fit together. There are stylistic points to this as well that relate to the musical style and what is expected in a particular genre of music, and then how that relates to particular processing practices as well within that style of music. So, you know, in 70s rock, the drum sound is very different to 80s or 90s metal, and certainly up-to-date metal. And so it's connecting some of those things that we can learn and teach on technical ear training to context, but almost, I would suggest, you know, to do it in context at the time. So yes, you check these parameters and then go, okay, well, let's hear how it sounds on this record. And this is what they've used on this record, and this is how it sounds. The work that Kirk and I have been doing over the last 50 years, I'm joking, I think it's only two, but it feels like a long time. But we, we're certainly advocates for multi-track audio recordings and the ways in which these can be used to teach not just mixing skills, but also critical listening skills as well. And just to raise your analogy, James, we can see a finished record as a baked cake, for example. And more often than not, we're asking students to appreciate the ingredients of that cake by tasting it at the end. And what multi-track materials allow us to do is to see the individual ingredients and maybe at least infer from seeing those and listening to those individual ingredients and then the finished product, what happened during the baking process or the mixing and production process. And that gives us the next level of insight, I think, to not just technical ear training, but also critical listening and also context-based music production learning, which I think is missing from it's missing from our program. And it's something that I think that actually can really open it. There are, of course, a number of different issues. There are copyright issues. There are various permissions issues along the way. But gaining access to good quality multi-track audio recordings within context. And what I mean by that is, Kirk Scott's, we went to the EMI archive, I think that's where we first met, wasn't it, James, when we nipped up to see you in Banff. We went to the EMI archive at the University of Calgary and we picked out some really sob stories for bands. We got some Canadian bands who tried to court the American market and the Americans didn't want them. And so then they were like, all right, well, we'll try the British market because they speak the same language as us. And the British market didn't want them. And then they were just left. But that's a really, it's an incredible resource for students to appreciate, not just the context of the music, but also the industry and how those audio recordings were made at a particular point in time by a particular group of people for a particular purpose. So it connects some of those, millions of decisions that were made throughout the production process to a historical narrative of a record that was either released or we found records that weren't released as well, which would be interesting in itself. I've got friends who've made records and they're still on the shelves because the record company didn't want to release them. And those could be really incredible resources. They allow us as researchers and students, as training practitioners and engineers and producers to see how decisions are made on broader musical concepts and musical ideas and music as a product necessarily. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Kelsey or James.
Oh, well, Kirk, you can go right ahead there if you want to say something.
Sure. I want to turn it on its ear a little bit here because I put something into the chat that is from our good friend Brechtemann and Semantic Audio Labs in the UK and some work that they've been doing on plugins that are actually have a semantic front end. And I think we could link this to some of what we heard from Elliot when he was working in the studios in Turkey and trying to translate Western terminology, sound recording terminology in DAWs in particular, into Turkish, and just the crazy sort of explanations that resulted from that. And because it was missing, the context was missing. It was just applied into a different, completely different social context. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on just flipping this completely and just using words to drive these machines. A boxy, you could put boxy into these plugins, and it will change the parameters and give you a boxy sound. They're being used by they basically upload many, many user parameters and come to, some kind of agreement about what boxy means to the majority of people. So just, it flips what you're trying to do with technical ear training right on its ear, because it just removes, we don't want the controls in this mode. In this mode, you want to drive it with the language. that we use in the studio. So just some thoughts on that, if you could.
Well, I think step one is finding agreement on what terms we use mean. I think that could take decades of argument, probably. If you had enough people in the room, there'd be no agreement on that end there.
And I'm not sure that having agreement on it would be a good thing either. Like, I feel like it's another problematic interface, you know, like I was complaining about compressors being informed by sort of what parameters we had access to in those devices at that time. And now we've had to learn this whole weird system that's become normalized and internalized in a lot of us. And I feel like partially it's because I'm a nerd and like my first instinct whenever I get a new thing is like, I wonder how I could take it apart and look at its guts. And so like, I'd want to figure out like what word I could use to do what in the thing. And I'd kind of be reverse engineering it. I'd be using words not based on the meaning I thought they had, but based on the behavior I see in the tool. Because I want to be able to use the tool. I want to do the translation from sort of, you know, ambiguous descriptive language into physical parameter changes. And I'm creeped out by anyone who tries to get in the way of that without telling me exactly what they're doing.
I love that, James. We have an ongoing battle in the United Kingdom, and it's with our automobiles. A lot of you guys in North America have lost it, but we have manual gear change and automatic. And you generally find that people are one or the other. If you like a manual gearbox, you're normally the type of person that James has described going, I don't want the car deciding when I change gears. I'm going to do that myself. You know, if it's snowing, I'm going to use a low gear. Or if, you know, I want the full control whenever the conditions are appropriate for me. I'm the other person. I bought an automatic car 2 years after I moved to Leeds because the traffic is awful. There's one way in and one way out. My left leg was dying from using the clutch. But that changed the way that I drive because I'm no longer thinking about, you know, various other things. All that decision-making has been taken away from me. I just stop and go. And I think that I wonder whether there's a similarity between those types of, you know, interfaces that have been around for so long. We've internalized some of those things around the frequency spectrum and stuff. And whether these newer tools that are coming out, I think Chris Lord-Alge's got a number of these, hasn't he? You know, guitar-based ones, a lot more growl or a lot more grit and stuff like that. And I must admit, I find it really interesting. I think there's a space for both of those. And I think both of those types of tools create a space for discussion with students or with even artists. You know, I think, you know, artists who aren't necessarily bothered about the, you know, the stick shift, the manual gear change, they just want the automatic because they're trying to get from A to B. They're not bothered whether they at this certain point they're going to have 50 miles an hour in second gear or whatever. And so I think it's nice that there are different tools and then using those semantic tools, aren't they? You know, those types of things and onomatopoeic sounds, which I suppose we could mostly agree on. We mostly agree on what a slap sounds like, I think, mainly. I think those types of interfaces could be really useful if those particular semantic choices are tied to onomatopoeic or maybe, you know, close to universally accepted ideas, possibly. I don't know whether that's possible though.
Something that is prevalent throughout, I mean, obviously discussion, but just our members here, you're all educators. And we've had, most of this has been discussed about an educational context. Does this, do you know professional engineers that return back to training they've had, or perhaps, obviously there's a definitely subset of engineers who never went to school, are anti-school, I learned it on the job, I was a roadie and I know everything now. Do you see those types of people, like either kind, revisiting this?
I'd say not often. I'd say like very quickly, the sort of not, they're just like life outside of the studio or the, you know, energy required to live in the studio sort of take over and push out a lot of, you know, what would seem like kind of extracurricular or frivolous like work.
Yeah, I would see, I mean, certainly the professionals that we have, but, you know, and we've got some distinguished professionals, certainly that that I've worked with, they're anti-education anyway. So this is next level stuff for them. You know, I see education as a process of enrichment. And, you know, if you start a process being hopefully not really good at something, and then you go through a process of enrichment to become better at something or a better all-round person. And if technical ear training or critical listening development can do that, then I think it's useful and powerful. Does it? I mean, the question I was writing Jordan James's presentation was, does ear training and developing critical listening skills help you make better music? How does this fit into the production process? And I think that the short answer to that is, of course it can do, but it does need to be guided, I think. You know, I've been to a lot of AESs where there's a lot of people from McGill who tend to just present on technical ear training. It seems to be a culture. It's created its own culture that feeds itself of technical ear training. And I wonder whether there's an opportunity for those in McGill to look at this idea of technical ear training, but how it applies more universally to various different production contexts to help maybe trainee engineers, student engineers develop further to make better records or better sounding recordings. I suppose that's my thought on it.
This isn't a direct kind of lead way, but just kind of the next question I have there is, should there be some kind of standardized training or certification for this skill? Because I know you can get it for DAWs or other essential skills, and a lot of people I know would completely scoff at the idea of getting a certification level in Pro Tools. But I guess there's definitely context where it makes sense if you need it for a certain job or if you don't have a degree. But should there be some kind of equivalent of standardized certification or testing for this? And what do you think that would look like?
I mean, I suppose if one did exist, you know, it would be, I can't imagine anything other than it being like a sort of, you know, set of like hurdles to jump through where, like, you know, you're timed and tested in some controlled way for your, you know, accuracy and speed. And it would sort of seem like kind of, I don't know, like a dog and pony show or something, probably, in terms of, you know, demonstrating proficiency at specific skills. But I don't think it'll ever have traction because of what Paul's saying, where like it can very easily have nothing to do with your proficiency at making music and making records, and, you know, being a craftsperson who helps artists, you know, build their music, or being a musician. It really, when I was teaching the course, I felt a constant need and a constant sort of effort to synthesize it with other things, because it's so detached from the actual practices we're doing, especially when it's not, you know, you in the studio with the tools you use. If it's some like purpose-built environment to test the skill set, it's so far removed from what we do that we really need to like always be drawing the line back to this is why, this is what muscle you're building. This is what, you know, attention to detail you're honing. And so I don't think in and of itself, the sort of skill set is useful enough to be worth certifying. And a lot of ways, that's probably what people think about, you know, being like avid certified or whatever. When they scoff at that, they probably think like, yeah, but what if that person is a dick? Then I don't want them in the studio, regardless of how much control they have over keyboard shortcuts.
Well, that does happen.
Yeah, more than I care to say. I think so. In I'm doing a lot of stories today, but I thought, why not? But in 2009, my university sent me down to London, and I went to the Apple store, the central Apple store near Piccadilly Circus, and it was to do the train the trainer thing. We did 3 days with this top professional in Logic, and after that 3 days, I realized what all of this software training was about. They wanted me to sell their software. He said, right, you're train the trainer and you're going to now deliver courses. And I was like, I'm not a software salesman. I'm a musician and a music producer. You know, I love music. I'm not interested in selling your software. So that's my thoughts on that. It's not, I don't necessarily think if someone is Avid certified or Apple certified, that it makes them any less worthy. If anything, the fact that they got through the slog of going through the exercises and taking the test when it's so boring is testament to their stickability, I think. But you're absolutely right. I think, and as James mentioned, and you mentioned as well, Kelsey, is that music production takes place in a social context. And so you have to learn those social skills alongside this. The temptation might be for people to see technical ear training or critical listening skills. If you're not balancing what you're hearing and you're pointing out to the artist that you're working with in the studio, well, that doesn't sound right, and they can't hear it, and you make them feel really uncomfortable and really stupid, you're not going to get much work in the recording studio. And I think, you know, there's a huge social element to the recording studio, a huge social side that as programs, I think we miss a lot. I don't know. I'm still at a loss as to how we fully teach that, and whether we do it in a scenario based way and say, okay, let's set up a scenario today and we can talk through ways in which you might deal with these particular things. That might be more useful. But it does get to a point of diminishing returns for me, is the amount of time and effort you have to invest in gaining a particular amount of technical knowledge compared to actually, if I just work with the person and make a couple of mistakes along the way, I might get there just as much. But I don't know, because I haven't done any technical ear training programs. I scoffed at them. I didn't really scoff, but I did. I did try Dave Moulton's Golden Ears one, and it is interesting. He's put a lot of work into that. It's a shame that no one's got to the end of it. But yeah, and Jason Corey's book is fab. I really like that. Alton Everest's book was useful, but I think my issue with a lot of it is that it's from a technical perspective. It's not looking through the prism of music production or from the producer or the studio engineer's idea. It's saying that, you know, this is what you're hearing and this is why you're hearing it, and that's it. And I think, yeah, wherever we can, connect it to the social, wherever possible. Oh, so yeah, your question was, so what would a qualification look like? I think James actually summed it up perfectly. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. So obviously, it exists in kind of some level in most training, whether it's more on the technical side, like pink noise, naming frequencies, or if it's in the creative, on the more of turning EQ knobs and seeing what happens. Do you think that teaching this to total beginners is feasible, or do you think that it requires previous audio or even just musical training or exposure?
I would say that teaching it to beginners is the best time. Like that's the best population for this kind of work, because the more mature the student is, the more experienced they are, the more their ability to funnel that facility into artistic production decisions and like human interactions matters way more. But at the beginning of somebody's career in learning about all these things, sort of accelerating the detail of their technical understanding, I think, because that's the foundation to build on, you know, being actually good at making music. You know, either you start and you're great at music and you just start fumbling your way through the gear and make a couple great records through sort of, you know, bullheadedness, or you start and it's just like, here's all the building blocks. We're going to teach you how to use a pencil, which end is the drawing end, which end is the erasing end. And then you can go off and make beautiful works of art once you've got the tools in your hands.
Okay, maybe just to refine the question a little bit. I do mean like a complete audio beginner. Do you think it would be useful still if they were someone who they don't know much about like audio signal flow or any basic principles such as that? Yes, Amanda.
Yeah, I just have something to add, answer about this. I think from my experience teaching first year students for a long time now, I found that those critical technical ear training models are very useful for very beginner to make them understand what it is to concentrate and focus. Because I found it's my biggest challenge when I have those classes of 20 plus students who all want to be a music producer. And most of them have already played with a DAW for several years. And it's just like, yeah, and now listen to this 5-second thing and decide whether or not there's a plus 6 dB EQ. And it's incredibly difficult for some of them. And I think that if I can link to what Paul was talking about earlier about the social aspects of the studio, I think that one of our big skills is to be able to listen, not just like if there's an EQ or if, you know, frequency range, or I don't know. It's being able to be aware, present, and knowing what's going on around us, and not just what people verbalize, but how they feel. You know, if a musician start being tired or upset, their sound will change, right? Their voice for sure, but also their violin sound or their guitar playing or aggressivity will come through, or, you know, and that awareness comes with being able to focus. And I found that it's something I need to teach 100 times more now than 10 years ago. Maybe because I became old, maybe that's the problem. Maybe, you know, but I think there's something about the amount of time people are doing 100 things at the same time, all day long, right? Texting their friends, being on the chat, trying to, you know, we all do that. I'm not going to say like we all do that. And that's a skill to have. It can be useful to a certain extent, but it also sometimes prevents young people to understand that there are moments you need to be there, like not doing 100 things and in yourself, or, you know, and so I think that's my link between those kind of geeky, you know, tool that I, of course, assess, because if I don't give points, nobody is going to practice. So I have to give points. And this is a terrible game of academia and I hate it, but it's part of the thing. If you sign up for a job, you need to play that game. But so the assessment is dumb. I'm not going to say the opposite, but the practice is not, because suddenly it's to be able to answer those questions, they need to be there, not doing 100 things at the same time. I don't know if I make my point, but that's something I found is so important. Yeah, thank you.
If I could just follow up on that point, because I think it's a brilliant one, and it's one that I think's been missing from this entire discussion, actually, which is concentration. And I think social media's got a part to play in this, but I think the way in which... well, social media is actually probably one of the biggest players in this because of the way that it's shrunk media formats to fit into shorter periods of time to hold people's attention across the platform longer, essentially. You know, if you were to look at what, you know, people's watching and listening habits, they probably listen to or watch little snippets of YouTube rather than big long films, because it requires that type of dedication. And I think critical listening is exactly the same. So I don't know, Amandine, are you suggesting teaching Zen studies and yoga studies alongside critical listening?
Yeah, I do, 100%. I mean, if I could teach The Artist Way by Julian Cameron for a full course, if I could teach, I would not teach yoga. I'm not certified. I'm a practitioner at a certain level, but I'm not certified. But if my students could take any kind of class in their first year to learn how to be there, whatever, there are tons of methods, and I'm not going to, you know, do a hierarchy, but I think it's what we should bring in audio education. And it goes, I mean, I know I bring up this gender thing all the time, but it goes with it. It's like awareness of other type of skills that makes people good at what they do, no matter what the task is. You know, because, I mean, Kelsey mentioned this, you know, like general kind of trend of hating audio education. I think, Kelsey, you told me that some people at AES who were themselves professors say they were against audio education, if I recall properly. No, I think we had that discussion the other day, or maybe I don't know. But this thing, I mean, I watched the AES convention the last couple of weeks, and so many people say how schools are useless. And when young people ask me, musicians or engineers, they ask me, should they go to college? And I say, yes, because we are going to teach you a bunch of stuff you will need in your life. And I usually speak about writing skills, which I found are also incredibly useful if you want to get a job, if you want to convince grant agencies, if you want to, you know, be able to make your point with artists and all sorts of things. So I think college can teach you that. And unfortunately, college don't yet teach you certain life skills that I think should be implemented. I know you have to, I mean, in Canada, I don't know how it is exactly at UVic, but at UofL, you have to take geography 101 and social sciences 101 and all sort of classes. And I know all of you complain about that. And I understand why, because it's not so much about the different disciplines. It's more, you need different perspectives on what it is to learn, what it is to do things, what it is to be with people. And I wish we could implement that in audio somehow. So I find critical listening in a way, and I mean, all the classes we do where people feedback on each other's mixes, and you know, which is part of critical listening, obviously, I found that it does make you better as you know, being in a social environment and express how you experience music, express how you experience other cultures' music. And I found those are very useful. But unfortunately, they're very hard to assess, right? I can just put participation points because you were there and you open your mouth. And that's sad, but, you know, that's sad. But that's part of the system that, and I think Kirk and I are trying to do this type of events to also go beyond this grading thing and this, how can we teach without having to fit in the grid and having to, you know, and I think the certification question goes with that, right? It's just like, would you be certified because you actually got 75% or 80% at the listening test? Hopefully not. But maybe there will be another way to assess.
Maybe I'll just pick up on that, Amandine, because, you know, this sort of, and your point about what we're trying to do with this, you know, building a community of practice, if you will, like from the sort of, you know, the situated learning models and the history of how recording was taught was through, you know, these places, through the studios. That's where the learning took place, and a lot of that learning is interconnected and confusing about what you're actually learning at this specific moment, and it's the time that you spend in that space that's important. So I just wanted to say that, you know, though we cannot be in the same space, this has been, I think, a really wonderful, for me, it's been wonderful to hear. You pick up tiny little things, you know, you feel like, If you're one of the students sitting there wondering, what have I just been listening to? But you do pick up these tiny little nuggets. And those are the things that I experienced through the studio, that when you put them all together, it's very different, because it's the timing and it's where those events occur in your path. If you were to just pick up the book and read all of those points on the first day, they would be, you know, many, many, many of them would just fall away and be useless to you. So anyhow, that's my piece. Thank you all for being
Thanks, here. Kay.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. So Paul, James and Kelsey for running this session. Thank you so much, and hope I see you or see you soon.
Cool, thanks everyone.